You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Chanter means to sing. It's French, and of course the word chant is related, but we often think of chanting as a certain category of singing, such as Gregorian chant. But chanting is highly diversified. It's part of innumerable cultures around the world. Have you ever heard of Altai throat singing from southern Siberia? Or what about traditional Zulu chant from South Africa? Halala, halala sanbongela, halala, halala sanbongela we. Halala, halala sanbongela, halala, halala sanbongela. Our next guest on Constant Wonder always chants unaccompanied as a soloist and at livestock auctions. Yes, chanting is the correct term for what an auctioneer does. It's a great pleasure to have with us now on the line Jared Miller, who was the 2018 World Livestock Auctioneer Champion. That's an event sponsored by the Livestock Marketing Association, which is North America's largest membership organization for the entire livestock marketing sector. And just a great delight to have Jared with us. Jared, thanks for joining with us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Jared, how long have you been at this? Can we talk in terms of a career that's in the middle or at the end? Or how many years?
Well, hopefully it's not the end. I'm 37 years old. I started when I was about 21 that I actually sold at auction. I always had I'm a third-generation auctioneer. My dad and grandfather had auctions, and so I kind of grew up around it. And my first job, I don't know how early it would have been, probably 6 or 7, was running clerking tickets for dad at one of his auctions. So that would be probably my first where I started falling in love with the auction chant and the auction industry, and it's brought me quite a ways.
So you've become champion, are you, in 2018, after mm-hmm. a relatively – I don't know how long a person can stay in this career before the vocal cords give out. I mean, is an auctioneer typically going to do 20, 30, 40 years?
Yeah, it can, and it comes down to a lot of breathing and what environment you're selling in. You know, breathing is a big thing, just like singers. It's the same thing for an auctioneer. If you breathe right, breathe out of your diaphragm instead of just out of your throat, you'll be able to go a long time. That's one question I get a lot of, is how can you sell that long without taking a break? And the easy answer is it comes down to breathing. You just learn how to. It's just like learning how to do construction or in your job in radio. There's tricks to the trade, and it's developing those, and you get to the point where it just doesn't wear on you.
So for a single event, how long are you required sometimes to chant?
You know, it varies. I've gone as long as, there's been auctions where I've sold for 6, 7, 8 hours at a time. So it varies. I mean, probably on average, you're looking at about 2 to 3 hours on average.
When you have one of those long hauls that goes for maybe 7 hours, does it take a day to recover?
Not usually. You know, one thing I try to do is drink a lot of water when I'm selling, and you know, it comes down to breathing, and as far as recovery, no, it's I can go the next day again.
Wow.
If I need to. Yeah.
Now, do you see yourself as being part of a tradition that's, I mean, this goes back, I would imagine, for centuries, But do you think about that much? It's kind of a rare thing to be doing this, and it's quite a tradition.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, the auction industry began way back when, 50 A.D., I believe is how far it dates back to. And I don't know. I mean, yeah, there's days that I think about the auction industry and how it's evolved from what it was back then to where it is now. And it's a business that's been great to me. And I love the industry. And as an old boy once told me, if you love what you do, you'll never have to work a day in your life. And there's a lot to that.
Yeah. Well, I would not know the first thing about what makes for a good auctioneer. What kinds of criteria do you apply to this, and the judges in particular, when they're judging you? What stands up as good auctioneering?
You know, there's several. A couple things that come to mind is clarity. You know, people have got to be able to understand you when you're auctioneering, because you're communicating what you're selling, how much you're asking, and then, you know, another big part is knowing the value of what you're selling. So that's another important part. You know, honesty, integrity are up there as well, because if people don't trust you, they're not going to do business with you. So there's a lot of factors, but you know, knowing the value, extremely important, and then clarity. If people can trust you, they're going to do business with you.
So you say knowing the value. I'm trying to figure out what that actually means. Do you look at livestock, or do you have papers in front of you? Do they bring sort of whether, you know, it's kind of a pedigree thing, or what's the value, and how do you know?
Yeah. So a lot of times the value is determined of you know, what are fat cattle selling for? What's it cost? What's your cost of gain when you're feeding these cattle? If they're going to gain 2, 3, 4 pounds a day, what's it going to cost you to put that gain on? Those are some of the factors that buyers take into consideration when they're sitting there buying. And so it's important for me to know all of that as well. You know, and conditions of cattle. You know, there's a lot of conditions in cattle. Are they weaned? Do they have what type of vaccinations do they have? What kind of are they all natural? There's so many different factors that play into that, and it's up to me as the auctioneer to make sure that I know what all these cattle have for vaccinations, whether they're weaned, you know, the condition. Are these cattle, you know, there's cattle that are in green condition, and what that means is they're thinner. They're gonna put on, when that buyer gets them and they start feeding them, they're going to put on a lot of weight in a short amount of time. Those cattle bring more than a calf that's carrying some flesh, you know, is kind of fat. So that's another factor that plays into it. So yeah, there's a lot of different things, and it's up to me to be able to point that out when I'm selling these cattle. You know, hey, I think there's a little more value here. They've had 2 full rounds of the vaccinations. You know, these cattle are green. Look at the weighing condition on them. And so it's important for me to know that, because we're a lot of times for these producers, these cattle producers, that's their one big paycheck of the year when they sell their calves. And so it's a pretty big responsibility on my part to be able to maximize the value on that day for those ranchers and farmers.
So when you're rattling off a chant, are you actually folding in vaccination information?
So a lot of times I do that to start with. You know, whenever we start selling on a new consignment, I'll have a piece of paper that has all the vaccinations. So on November the 10th, these cattle had the Pyramid 5 at the pre-spawns. They've had they were boosted with the same shots 2 weeks later. They were weaned on October the 5th. So a good long wean on these cattle, and then you go into selling them. And then obviously when you change consigners, so we finish up a consignment and change consignments, you do it all over again. But there are times that when you are selling, you know, you just either throw it in your chant or you stop and say, no, they do have 2 full rounds. There's times where, you know, another thing that an auctioneer becomes is a lip reader, because there's times where a buyer might ask, you know, are they weaned? And a lot of times you can kind of see what they're saying just in your chant. You said, yes, they are, 45 days. Or, you know, you just throw it in like that because time is money when you're selling cattle too, because these cattle are out back in the pens, and the quicker we can move them through there, the better it's going to be for our producers because they're going to be able to sell more weight. What I mean by that, if these cattle are standing back there in the pens, they're not. They're a lot of times, you know, they'll come in that the day before or that morning, and they'll be standing in a dry pen where they won't have any water. So after the sale, everything gets moved to water and taken care of that way. But just from a space standpoint, they can't all go directly to water when they get here. So that's another factor that plays in.
I think you just answered a big question for me, which is to say that the speed of the chant is actually a matter of efficiency in expediting the sale.
Yes. Yep.
It's not just show. It's not just a song. It's not just fun. There's actual method to the madness of it all. You're trying to move the cattle quickly.
Yes, that is correct.
Wow.
Time is money.
Wow, I had no idea. Now, how do you get good at this? Do you go to a school? Do you just learn from your dad? You say you're third generation. How do you hone the skills?
So I did both. I did go to auction school. I do a lot of contract auctioneering work. What that is someone might hire me for a day to sell equipment, or I sell a lot of purebred cattle sales as well. And that's completely separate of my livestock market business. And so there's certain states that require a license, and in order to get a license, you have to have a school diploma. So I did go to the Worldwide College of Auctioneering in Mason City, Iowa, in the winter of 2009, and it's a 9-day school there. And so I did go through school. Obviously, I mentioned third generation. I got a lot of it from Dad. Dad was a great auctioneer. He was kind of a student of the game. He enjoyed auctioneering. So we'd go to auctioneering contests from time to time. And there's certain chants like Ralph Wade's and a lot of great auctioneers. I can't name them all. Terry Elson, another one from Nebraska. Just guys that stood out to me. I just something about their chant that I liked, and so you learn to mimic them a little bit possibly, but it's still I'd like to think that my chant is Jared Miller's chant. It's not Ralph Wade's chant, or it's not someone else's chant. It's pretty personalized to myself. And but yeah, you just practice. It's just like any other job that you want to be good at. You've got to put in the work. You've got to work on your craft and just get better every day.
So you have your own signature Jared Miller style.
I'd like to think so, yeah. Yep.
What could you describe for us that characterizes that style that makes it distinct from others?
You know, I don't know that it's completely different from other people. I wouldn't say that part, but one thing that I work on a lot is clarity. It's communicating, and every auctioneer, every person communicates differently with people, and so it's just I guess my way of doing it. I don't know that it's any different than any other way, but there's a sound that every auctioneer has. You know, you listen to a lot of auctioneers, and I've yet to find someone that sounds exactly like someone else.
So before we conclude our conversation, I hope you're prepared to give us a little demo.
Yeah.
We're not there yet, but I promise you we're going to get to that. I want to know about how much money goes through these events. I mean, the cattle are pricey, and if you're expediting, we've already talked about the fact you're trying to make this happen quickly. Mm-hmm. I would imagine a lot of money exchanges hands.
Yeah, it absolutely does. So during a year's time in the United States, more than 34 million cattle, 7 million hogs, and 3 million sheep and lambs are sold at auction, and that's to the tune of more than $30 billion in gross sales. So the auctions are extremely important to the livestock industry. You know, these producers, it's just – yeah, it's a big factor for them whenever they go to sell their cattle. The nice thing about an auction is it doesn't matter if you have 10 head of cattle or 10,000 cattle, it gives you the same opportunity at a livestock market. You know, when you sell 10 head of cattle, a lot of times when you take them to a livestock auction, there might be 2, 3, 4, 10,000 more to go with them. And so it gives those cattle get to sell right with the bigger drives of cattle, and it it gives the small guy the same opportunity as it does the producer that has a large number of them.
Is there anything about this procedure that is a little bit old-fashioned, that it's going to go away, or is this with us to stay? I we live in the digital age, and I would imagine there's people inventing newer ways to make this happen electronically or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's hard to reinvent the wheel. We talked about at the beginning of the interview how long the auction industry has been around, and it's worked it works. If anything, technology's probably helped us be able to reach another level that we maybe wouldn't have got to without it. Just with the online part of things, we sell some cattle online, especially in the purebred bulls and cows. We sell a lot of those online. There's still a lot of people want to see their the feeder cattle sector of it. There's still a lot of people that want to see what they're bidding on in person. You can emulate a lot on the video, but it's still people want to see what they're bidding on. And so the live auction, I don't believe, is going to go anywhere. If anything, like I mentioned, you know, the internet has helped it. It gives us access to a bigger crowd, whether that's marketing or on auction day.
Now, after you win a championship, I'm thinking, for example, of Miss America. You know, she goes on tour. Is there something comparable to that, where after you win a championship, you get to do the rounds?
Yeah, there is. So I was fortunate enough to win it in 2018, and I got the opportunity to travel the country representing for livestock marketing associations. And I visited right close to 30 different livestock markets and auction events across the country, and went from Georgia to Montana to Idaho to Wisconsin, all over really the Midwest, and then even further out into the West, and just representing the Livestock Marketing Association. And it was such a great thing for me. I enjoy people, and so I got the opportunity to meet a lot of people from across the country, and it something that I'll look back on, and I'll certainly have a lot of fond memories of.
And each of those events you went to on tour, were they bona fide, genuine, real events where you're auctioning, or was some of it just display?
No, it was actual auction. So my first appearance that I went to was in Billings, Montana, and it was the Northern Livestock Video Auction, and I believe we marketed 160,000 cattle over those 2 days. And so, that was my first appearance, and it just kind of went on from there. But yeah, everyone a real live auction. I did also have opportunities to speak to FFA chapters along the way, 4-H chapters along the way too, on several of those occasions.
Now, when I think about everything from agriculture to ranching, I think about how the trend over the last 50-plus years, maybe 75 years, is for big corporations to step in and take over. Can you describe the situation, the lay of the land, in terms of are you auctioning for these big outfits and the big buyers?
Yes, on both cases, sellers and buyers both. I started working at Lamoni Livestock Market, which we now own, back in 2009. And what we sell cattle now versus what we did then, the overall numbers are pretty close to the same. They just come in different sizes. You know, you see back then there was a lot of smaller producers, and what I mean by smaller producers was, you know, 20 to 40 head operations, and there's still some of those around. But what we've seen now is some of those 20 to 40s are no longer have cattle, and the guys that would sell 100 are selling 200 and 300, and so it's certainly has trended that way. I don't know the cattle industry is it's tough. It's a tough industry as far as you always have chores, and so that part is something that doesn't appeal to maybe the next generation quite as much, and so they've gotten jobs in towns, and so that's an issue. The age of the American farmer, that's certainly an issue that hasn't just keeps getting older as the days go on. As far as the buying part of it, that has as well. We live here in Iowa, southern Iowa, and it's big farmer country. Iowa is obviously known as a big corn state, and a lot of cattle get fed in Iowa. Some of that has gone, or more and more of it every year has gone to corporate feeders feeding these cattle, and it's a lot the same. You know, the older farmers always fed their cattle because that's what Dad did, and it's gotten to be where a lot of the next generation enjoys the row crop part of it, but would rather not be around on the weekends, maybe, and want to take some vacations, and I don't blame them. Yeah, it's certainly gotten older there as well, and yeah, more corporate.
Changing landscape for
sure. Yeah, for sure.
Well, here we are now, and I'm ready for you to lay it on me, and I want to see if I can even understand a single word, because you've talked about clarity, but I am a complete novice at listening to this. I might be able to pick out a word or two.
All right, we'll give it a try.
Okay.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the auction's on a fancy set of 552-pound steers in the ring. And tell me, and time at a dollar, what are you going to do on them? Give a dollar 60, now one. I'm at a dollar 60, here, now one, now two, down 63, there, I'm going to give $4, down five, now five, I'm going to go down, down 166, here, down seven, now eight, there, nine, there, now $70, down a bird, now one. I'm at a dollar 70, there, I'm going to give 71, sir, now one, done. They're long weaned. They've had two full rounds of the vaccinations. Give 71 on them, now two, now three, and now four, $9, 74, dollars. On them, and I have 173 there. Now I'm gonna get $4 on them. Already done 173. I'm gonna give $1.74 for them one time, and I have four. Sold the cattle at $1.73. They're gonna go to 52 on five.
You didn't even take a breath. You know, this is, I understood some of that. What's the reason for the music in it? There's a real music to it. It's kind of the same pitch. So, you know, you're hovering around that same general pitch. But what does that do for you, or for the listeners?
You know, the music, and I've been to auctions where there's an auctioneer that they're effective. They can gather the money, but they're not really nice to listen to, and that's something that. It's just the brutally honest. But that's something that, you know, is if someone can sit there and listen to you all day long, I think that says a lot about your chant. And so that's something that I've tried to do. Now there might be people that think I'm terrible and they wouldn't listen to me for 5 minutes, and that's okay. But that's something that if there's a cadence to it, there's not really a sing song, but a cadence that's inviting. I think it helps.
Yeah. Well, Jared, this has just been fun for me to explore a world that I know so little about. I've got a grandfather who was a cattle rancher and a farmer, and I've got cousins galore who know the industry. I just grew up in the city, and so you're kind of a rare breed in my experience, and it's a pleasure to get to meet you and to learn about what you do.
Absolutely. I'm glad I could oblige.
Jared Miller with us. He was the 2018 World Livestock Auctioneer Champion, and that's sponsored by the Livestock Marketing Association. Auctioneering has survived for generations, but will it last? Where I live, suburbia has nudged out pastures and corrals, so if you want to experience anything of the Old West these days, you have to know where to look. And we're going to explore that question next on Constant Wonder. Thanks for joining with us today for Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith.
And I'm Tenery Taylor. A few years ago, my husband went along on a youth activity with some of the local teenaged boys. He didn't tell me that much about it until it was over, for which I am very grateful, since the highlight of the trip was bull riding. on a real bull? I think I asked him, hoping that he meant they rode mechanical bulls with on and off buttons and variable speeds. But no, it was the real thing. And of course, they all got thrown and probably nearly killed. I'm just so glad I wasn't there. And that's about as close as I think my family ever needs to get to the Wild West. But of course, the allure of the fearless cowboy braving whatever nature throws at him is powerful and inextricably tied to the history of the West and America. But how much actually remains of the Wild West today? It's a question that author Ian Neely wanted to answer himself, and the results of his research can be found in his latest book, Spurred West: Rogues, Treasure Seekers, Bounty Hunters, and Colorful Characters Past and Present. Ian Neely, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Where did you grow up, and how did your own past influence this project?
Oh, yeah, great question. So I grew up in Colorado. And you know, certainly my family did quite a bit of traveling around the West growing up. Like many kids in the West, I heard stories of the Wild West. You know, Billy the Kid, Buffalo Bill, Wild Bill Hickok, and folks like that. And so it was kind of ingrained, kind of in my DNA. you know, during my first book, Gold, Madness, Murder, and Mayhem in the Colorado Rockies, I learned there were still people living in the shadow of the Colorado Gold Rush, and I started to wonder more broadly if the Western region still had people embracing some of the wilder aspects of the Old West.
So how easy is it to answer that question? I mean, did you have to ask around and ingratiate yourself with people you might not have normally hung out with?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because when we think about, the Wild West, you know, sometimes we kind of combine that with thoughts of the Old West. And we know that the Old West was a time period with a very specific beginning and end, you know, roughly the end of the Civil War to the beginning of the 1900s. The Wild West, however, was kind of comprised of real people and things that had happened, as well as some fictitious ones. And so I kind of went about trying to decide and find out what was real from back then, and if it existed in some aspect today. I can say that absolutely, during the Old West, it was quite wild. And today there are still people who kind of embrace that spirit of the Wild West.
You said, though, the Wild West was somewhat fictitious, maybe like mythical. And sure. I'd like to talk about a character who maybe really encouraged that myth, Buffalo Bill.
Oh yeah.
What's his role in promoting the myth of the Wild West?
Oh, I think he, more than any other character from that time period, was largely responsible for the creation of our concept of the Wild West. Buffalo Bill was a really interesting character. He was an army scout. He was a buffalo hunter. He had a very exciting life, but he didn't really come to any kind of prominence until a journalist came out and found him. The guy's name was Ned Buntline, and he was a notorious liar and tall tale teller. And he found Buffalo Bill, Cody, and the two hit it off. And he went and wrote a story. Basically called, Buffalo Bill, the wildest and truest tale I've ever told. And predictably for Ned Buntline, it was.
Can something be the wildest and the truest? I just,
yeah, no,
I think that's
not
a tip.
Yeah, well, that's the hint. Yeah. And I think in his case, maybe predictably, it was utterly fabricated. But it was a huge hit for people back East. And it really launched, Cody into sort of a new level of stardom. And he began to sort of go back East and perform these little like plays and vignettes, giving people back East a sense of what it was like to be out on the plains. And they were notoriously horribly acted. But people went to see it in droves because they had a real hunger and fascination for what the West was.
And he took animals too, right? in these shows.
Right. Well, in time, he decided to start creating a bigger show that would travel from town to town called Buffalo Bill's Wild West. And really, you know, he would bring animals and he would bring sort of the last vestiges of the West with him around from town to town. And it was less of a circus and more of like an educational experience, quote unquote. And that really sort of helped perpetuate what we think of as the Wild West. And some of it was true and some of it was fabricated. There's a reason why people in Europe, when they think of Native Americans, they often think of, tribes like the Sioux, the Plains Indians, because that was Buffalo Bill's experiences out on the plains. And that's what he brought with him. To answer your question, absolutely. He very much sort of drove that myth and fact forward into sort of our modern day consciousness.
Now, you can't have the Wild West without gunfights.
Right. That's true.
Were they as common as they appeared in the movies?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. Obviously there weren't as many gunfights as it seems like if you watch a movie about the Wild West or the Old West, you can't walk to the barber shop without getting into a gunfight. But in reality, there were far fewer gunfights, although they certainly did happen. And there were characters that, you know, like James Butler, Wild Bill Hickok, who was, you know, a very real gunslinger for the time and quite a deadly, gunfighter. There's the very famous, shootout in Tombstone, sort of the erroneously titled OK Corral, you know, shootout at the OK Corral. And that really was probably the biggest gunfight of that time period. And 30 bullets were fired in about 30 seconds. And three men were killed and three were wounded. And it sort of launched this Wyatt Earp's vendetta ride where he hunted down these guys that had later come back for retribution and wounded and killed one of his brothers. And, you know, that was very real. But in a lot of respects, you know, when talking to historians and museum curators and folks that really understand that time period and what was being used, it was less people with, you know, pistols shooting at each other and more, you know, folks trying to survive and often carrying things like shotguns to go hunting with. Unless, you know, the really polished, you know, Doc Holliday types, although they certainly existed.
But your project was to find any remnants of this culture left in today's West. And you did actually find some modern day gunslinging. Will you tell us about the quick draw competitions that you observed?
Yeah, the cowboy fast draw folks. So there are various organizations, including the cowboy fast draw, that meet up and they dress up in period appropriate costumes and they compete in a number of, you know, competitions involving firearms. So during my research for the book, I went to the Four Corners Territorial Fast Draw Championship in Pagosa Springs, Colorado, and met with David and Shirley Miller, who have been involved in cowboy fast draw for quite a while. And in this case, what people do is they line up and, a buzzer will sound and they will shoot at a target with wax bullets. And it's all about accuracy and speed. And in some cases, you know, people do quite a lot of interesting things to make that happen. When you see an old movie, the gunslingers are standing upright and they usually maybe they'll hunch forward and grab their pistol and pull it out and fire. But some of these folks were bending all the way backwards, like they were doing, you know, like the limbo, you know, they were sort of bending way backwards so that they could easily reach their pistol and pull it out quickly and fire it.
And, that just wouldn't look the same in a movie.
it doesn't. No, it kind of ruins the illusion a little bit. It looks a little silly, but it works for them. But there are a lot of different organizations like that all over the world, and including in Japan, where it's also a very popular sport.
Now, they're always shooting at a target. They don't try to recreate like a duel, do they?
No, in this case, they don't. It's all about how fast you can beat the clock and if you can beat the person standing next to you. But there is actually a very vibrant group of folk out there that dress up in Western garb and shoot blanks at one another as reenactors, kind of like a Civil War reenactor.
Sure, sure.
And there's these Wild West reenactors.
So do they show up every time as the same character? I mean, have they kind of – do they take on a new persona and then they always show up in character?
Yeah, I think it just depends on what they're getting hired to do. I know that there are folks that like to show up as Wild Bill Hickok, and there are people who probably dress up as Billy the Kid. But in this respect, and these guys that I was talking to, they're just kind of like general sort of unclean outlaws. They take the dirt and the grime that they wear very seriously so that they look very authentic. And it's my understanding that nobody likes to play the good guys. I can't quite imagine why, but they like to dress up as the bad guys. And so they travel all around and do that. And it's actually quite dangerous. They have to be very careful because there have been incidences over the years of people accidentally being shot at these events. And so these guys that I talked to who are located not far from Bailey, Colorado, they always shoot at the ground just in case. They always have law enforcement check their firearms to make sure that they're blanks and they're not loaded with live rounds. But these things happen. It even happened in Tombstone, which is probably one of the most famous Wild West reenactments. And sometimes live bullets are found in these guns. So they have to be very, very careful about how they proceed.
Well, we've talked about cowboys. How about American Indians? Because they're definitely part of the story of the West. And I know you have a chapter on powwows in your book. What's the legacy that American Indians want to preserve, and how different is it from the cowboy legacy?
That's a great question. They're very different stories. The Wild West, the Old West, is really sort of a combined myth for Americans created shortly after the Civil War to help bring together and unify this country. It was sort of a shared mythology. We know that the experience of the Native Americans and the indigenous peoples was very different and quite heartbreaking. If you look at, we were talking about Buffalo Bill Cody, I was curious to know because he had Native Americans in his Wild West show, and I was curious to know kind of how they looked at that and how they sort of think about him. Was he sort of taking advantage of them? Well, okay, maybe a little. But he is regarded very well by the Native Americans that I spoke to because he treated them fairly and paid them fairly, which was unheard of at the time. And in a lot of respects, they could sort of continue to enjoy and practice their culture, albeit, on display. But they could still practice their culture and perform the ceremonies that they were, used to doing without government interference, which was not the case at the time. A lot of folks that had run across the government and in kind of negative ways went and kind of hid out with his show for years because they could live freely, so to speak, with him at the time. So I thought that was very interesting that he was looked at in a positive light.
Because his show was not a parody. He was really trying to bring, the true West and maybe mythologize it a little bit, but it was not making fun of cowboys or Indians.
No, absolutely not. And I think that, when we say Wild West show, the show part really wasn't part of the name. It was really Buffalo Bill's Wild West because he wanted it to be a slice of life. And of course, all the big battles and shootouts ended with Buffalo Bill Cody arriving to save everyone. And maybe that wasn't so accurate. But in a lot of respects, some of it was quite accurate for the time. And so I think that was the experience, for some of the indigenous people that traveled with him. They had good experiences with him because he was a fair guy. As far as the powwows go, I was curious to know sort of, how those developed and when. And so I spoke with the folks for the Denver March powwow, which is one of the largest ones in the region, and talked to them about how important it is for them to be able to participate in these dances and these, you know, these ceremonies, and how it keeps a community, you know, active and engaged. And it's really kind of an amazing thing. I really recommend if anybody gets a chance to go to one and attend it and be a spectator, it's quite amazing.
We've been talking about Buffalo Bill, and of course he took his name from the bison, which are not really buffalo, but it's bison that we actually have in the West. How important are today to cowboy and to American Indian culture?
Well, it's interesting because I think towards the end of the Wild West, the Old West time period, they realized what they had done. American bison or the buffalo were such an important part of life on the plains and of the indigenous peoples. And the government took a very active role in trying to eliminate them from the plains and as a food source from the Native Americans. And they were also used to feed the folks building the railways and the scouts and the army. And when they ran out, that's when they imported cattle. And there's a whole sort of really interesting and bizarre history to cattle being introduced into the West and sort of the wars that were fought over that. And I got the chance to meet modern day cattle brand inspectors who hunt for cattle rustlers today. But as far as the early 1900s, some cities, I believe San Francisco is one of them. Denver certainly is one of them. They realized kind of that was the bison, the buffalo were an essential part of that Western spirit of the Wild West, and went out of their way to sort of wrangle up herds from the last free herd near Yellowstone and brought them to, at least in our case, to the Front Range and have them today. You can still find them on the alongside of I-70. As you drive up to the ski resorts, you can sometimes see a herd of bison. And they're just there as a memento, as a reminder of the heritage of the West. And I think for a lot of people, that's still the case.
Yeah. You mentioned cattle rustling, you know, and that, of course, we see in the movies. But, I mean, is that still happening today? And, I mean, is that still a problem for ranchers today?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. So, it's, you know, cattle rustling has been a huge issue in this country's history, almost since cattle were introduced. And it was a pretty bloody fight between rustlers and stockmen for years. And they were smart enough sort of to introduce the brand inspectors and that whole policy of branding cattle and of getting them proper documentations and certification and knowing how to track them. And that really cut down on a lot of cattle theft, but it certainly didn't eliminate it. And so I spent some time with modern day brand inspectors, and it's their job to do more than just look for cattle rustling, but that is a very important part of their industry. And there are people who still steal cattle. It's not, I don't think it's quite as common as it was maybe 130 years ago, but certainly is a problem that that they face, and people are still jailed and you know, found guilty of stealing cattle today. And thankfully, unlike, you know, 100 and some years ago, you know, the answer to cattle theft isn't being hung. You know, it's maybe a little bit of jail time and fines. Mm. But yeah, still very much a problem.
If you're just joining us, this is Constant Wonder, and I'm Tenery Taylor speaking with Ian Neely. He's the author of Spurred West, Rogues, Treasure Seekers, Bounty Hunters, and Colorful Characters Past and Present. We're going to take a quick break here. And when the show comes back, we're going to learn about a little adventure that Neely had at the Mountain Man Survival School. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Constant Wonder. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Our guest today is Ian Neely. He's the author of Spurred West, Rogues, Treasure Seekers, Bounty Hunters, and Colorful Characters Past and Present. We were just talking about cattle rustling, which means, you know, we've got to have some some people tracking down the bad guys. So you ran into U.S. Marshals and bounty hunters. which seem kind of mythological. I mean, don't we have policemen and the FBI to do those kinds of jobs?
Yeah, today we certainly do. You know, back during the Old West, the U.S. Marshals really were the only source of reliable law enforcement for the territories. And obviously, they become mythological over time, and they still have, you know, that job today. They still go out and they find criminals and folks on the run from the law, much as they did back in the day.
You ought to tell us, actually, the story of Bass Reeves, just to get a flavor of what it was like back in the day.
You know, I was really, really excited to come across the story of Bass Reeves. And I wouldn't say that he's a forgotten character, but he has largely been forgotten. Bass Reeves was an escaped slave and likely the greatest lawman of the West. He captured during his 32 years of working as a deputy U.S. Marshal, a staggering 3,000 criminals. He would often use disguises, and his skill with a firearm was considered by some to have inspired the creation of the Lone Ranger.
How did he come to escape slavery?
You know, it was right about the time of the Civil War, and he was brought to Texas by one of his slave owners, and they were playing a game of poker, and things got heated, and he ended up knocking out the slave owner and fleeing for the Oklahoma Territory. During his time on the run, he ended up learning a bunch of different languages and became versed with the Native American groups that were living in that area. And when the time came to sort of start up the U.S. Marshals in the Oklahoma Territory and begin recruiting people, he was a natural fit because of his skill with a firearm and the fact that he spoke multiple languages.
Now, bounty hunters today, what are some of the tools of their trade, and how similar are they to the work that they were doing back in the Wild West, Old West?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of respects, depending on the state that you're in, and certainly in the West, we still have bounty hunters. Not a lot has changed. They have to be very careful not to get themselves into trouble because it's a very fine line between being a successful bounty hunter and being incarcerated for doing something illegal. So they have to be very careful.
Are they police officers? Yeah. Do they work with police departments, or are they kind of just for hire contract agents?
Yeah, they're contract agents. They work with like a bail bondsman. So if somebody has to get bail to get out of jail while they're waiting for their court date, if they jump bail, if they don't go to court like they're supposed to, if they don't pay the bail that they borrowed from the bail bondsman, the bail bondsman has a certain period of time to get that person back into court, or else they are out the money. So that's when they hire somebody like a bounty hunter. They may have people already on their payroll. They may look for somebody who's a freelancer.
Now, before we leave you, I want to talk about the landscape of the Wild West. You know, the concept of the frontier was so important to this story, this great unknown to explore and to test yourself against. Now that the country's pretty much settled, how do people capture that feeling of exploration today?
It's interesting because, you know, yeah, the country is settled, but between the cities, between the municipalities, it's still pretty rugged and wild. You know, certainly in our neck of the woods, people are being rescued all the time by going out into the wilderness and being found, and sometimes alive and sometimes not, because it's dangerous. And so it's wise to go out, even if on a small hike, to be and be prepared for whatever you may face. And one way folks do that is they attend an outdoor survival school class. And that's a great way to sort of learn some of the basic skills that you might need to survive out in the wilderness. And I did get the chance to do that myself. I wanted to get a sense for what it was like to be out in the wilderness and not have sort of some of the modern luxuries. And granted, it was only a week that I spent outside. So it wasn't, you know, I wasn't spending years, but it really gives you a sense for how difficult it was.
So describe a day at the Mountain Man Survival School that you went to.
Sure. Well, the Mountain Man Survival School is operated by Jason Marsteiner, and he's been doing it his entire life. And he's a very accomplished a survival school instructor. He also is great about teaching, which is wonderful because, you know, I was never a great camper myself. And so it was really helpful to have somebody like Jason explain how to make fire, how to use the tools around you in your environment to live. Because really there's like a rule of three. You can survive, you know, 3 days without water. You can survive 3 weeks without food. You can survive, you know, just a very short period of time without shelter. And so he teaches you in a given day how to make shelter and how to survive off the land in a very basic way, but long enough.
Did you have to build a shelter? I'm curious what yours looked like.
I did. I slept in my tent for the first few days and had some troubles with that because it was placed by myself next to a giant cow patty that I hadn't realized was there when I set up.
Oops.
So I was being bombarded with flies and it was kind of a nightmare. So I got the chance to build my own shelter and it was kind of like they call it a jungle hooch, and it was up off the ground by about 4 to 5 feet. And it was a platform, kind of like a funeral pyre in a lot of respects, now that I think about it. So you put the bedding, you put pine needles and things like that. You put sort of a tarp over you and I just hope that you didn't roll out in the middle of the night. Other than that, I mean, it was, away from my other tent, which was a wonderful luxury. I'm kind of a restless sleeper, so I was careful not to roll too much to one side or the other.
Now, would you say the West is still wild? What's your conclusion after this year that you spent?
I mean, the West is limited by its geography, and the Old West is restricted by its place in history. But I don't think that the spirit of the Wild West is limited to any one place or people. I think it's less of a region and more a way of thinking. It's where people are, in my opinion, still judged by their tenacity and grit. And I think it's always evolving, but more than anything, yes, I absolutely believe the West is still wild.
We've been speaking with Ian Neely. He's the author of Spurred West, Rogues, Treasure Seekers, Bounty Hunters, and Colorful Characters Past and Present. Thanks for joining us on Constant Wonder.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Tenery Taylor.
And I'm Marcus Smith. At the turn of the 20th century, a European showman used premature infants in sideshows, all to promote the use of incubators. That story coming up next on Constant Wonder.